Hey everyone, I'm Jason V, and this is Local Color. If you're a fan of the TV show Empire, chances are you've seen artwork that my next guest has carried in her gallery. Mirtis Padilla has the distinguished privilege of being one of 10 women of color in the United States to own and operate a successful art gallery. Her career has taken her to several African countries, including Zimbabwe, where she learned Shoshona, a language indigenous to the southern country. We talk about her childhood in Chicago, her career in the arts, and how as an art dealer, she has to keep a lookout for forgeries. Now, your name is it Mirtis or Mirtis?
It's Mirtis.
Mirtis. That's an interesting name. Do you know how you got it?
Yes, I was named after my mother's dearest friend. The name is Greek in origin, of which I am not. But it also has some relation or ties to France. Maybe, you know, French. So maybe it leapt from one country to the other. But, yeah, so I was named after my mother's dearest friend.
Now, is your mother's dearest friend, or so her name would be Mirtis, correct?
She's Big Mirtis, I'm Little Mirtis.
Now, is Big Mirtis from Greece?
She is not. I believe her family is from the New Orleans area.
Oh, okay.
Yes.
So I guess maybe that's the French connection that
correct.
You were talking about. Gotcha.
Yes.
Now, are you from Baltimore?
Not originally. I'm from Chicago.
Oh, well, tell me about Chicago.
I love Chicago, with the exception of the weather, which is why I haven't resettled there. Chicago's a beautiful, vibrant city. The arts are very exciting there to me. I still have family members that live there, so I go back annually to visit. But I've made Baltimore my home.
Would you say it's a culturally rich city?
Absolutely. Culturally rich, culturally diverse. Food is really wonderful because you have people of different ethnic backgrounds that bring their wonderful flair to, you know, the food experience. And it shows itself in the art, too. It's very diverse and very vibrant.
Well, what's the demographics? Because as someone who's never been there and who mm-hmm. just sees about it on TV, it just seems like it's just white people and black people.
Oh, wow. Yeah. Well, that combination includes a lot of Hispanic people, Mexican, Salvadorian, Peruvian, there's Polish, Jewish, you know, you have like all these little segmented areas throughout the city where people have settled, Germans and others. And then there's places where that meshes, and that tends to be food and music and the arts.
Well, how do you think Chicago became such a cosmopolitan type city? Because if you think of all the other ones like D.C., New York, L.A., and in some respects Miami or Florida, all of that's by the coast or by water. But mm-hmm. Chicago is like, I guess, right in the middle of the United States, and it borders. Does Illinois border Canada?
No, it doesn't.
Oh,
it's
okay.
Further south.
Further south. Okay,
mm-hmm.
But regardless, it's a landlocked mm-hmm. state. Why do you think Chicago has such a prestigious reputation about it?
Today, I think that could be said. I mean, the roots of Chicago and the history of the city are that of, you know, an industrial town. We had all these industries and factories, and so it became a place where a lot of immigrants settled. From what I can remember as a child, we had, like, where animals were slaughtered, you know, the stockyard, as they called it. And then, you know, we had the factories there, the steel mills were there. So it had the blue-collar jobs available. And that's what kind of fed and nurtured all of these people and where they settled and how they made their money and incomes. So, I mean, I've lived I've moved away from Chicago, gosh, over 30 years ago. So going back, I feel like an outsider now because the demographics has changed. Geographically, it's very different in terms of where people live now versus when I was there. But I go in as an outsider and just love all the wonderful things that it has to offer.
What was growing up in Chicago like?
Well, for me, it was really quite wonderful. My father he's passed away now, but he was a professional jazz musician and played, you know, with some of the jazz greats.
What did he play?
He's stand-up bass.
Okay.
So he was a jazz bass player. And with that experience came opportunities for some of the smaller bands that he played with as I got older to come and rehearse at my home. And so, you know, I just grew up really loving music. And my mother, she worked for the phone company, so I kind of grew up in this middle class, you know, black community. We integrated. We were one of the few first families to move into our neighborhood that was black. So, you know, that is another story and another time. So I grew up in this wonderful, rich music environment. My mother plays the cello, and so there were times when my parents would play together. And so it was quite wonderful for me.
Good. This is a quick aside. I'm going to get to the next question. But recently, I think last year, I bought my mom this book. Have you ever heard of this book called Negroland?
I have heard of it. I have not read it.
Now, is that a term or concept that you were familiar with growing up in Chicago? Because my mom talked to me about it as she was reading the book. Mm-hmm. And I guess the idea of upwardly mobile black or African-American families, I think that idea or the idea of Negroland started in Chicago. Mm-hmm. I could be wrong, but like, are you familiar with that concept at all?
I am familiar with it. I think for me, my parents were not, I don't know that they would have been considered part of that group. That tended to be a terminology that was more associated with like the doctors and the lawyers. My parents didn't have college. They were not college educated. Although my father could have, he resisted it. His father was a college educated man. Actually, his father, my grandfather, on my father's side, was a principal of a school. So my father's family, they would have been considered wealthy by any means during that period in the late 1800s and early 1900s. My mother's family background, lower class. Not that they didn't have things. They did. My grandfather owned his own business. But, you know, the economy then is far different, of course, than it is now. So the class systems would have been defined very differently.
Now, with that, growing up, if you can remember it, did you ever notice that your parents had different value systems?
Yes, at times, very much so. Given my father's, I wouldn't say privileged background, but the fact that he grew up with, I remember seeing pictures of my father's family and very refined clothing. My aunts, when they would visit, it was amazing. They had gloves up to their elbows. I thought they were models, honestly, and they were just so stunning and so beautiful to me. My father's father also owned land, and when we went to visit, they were part of, I believe they were probably part of that Oklahoma black, you know, enclave folks. And I went to visit their homes, and we would drive down these long driveways, and they had private ponds and horses. It just blew me away. Then I juxtapose that against my mother's family, who they had homes and everything as well, but they didn't have, the wealth was not as it was with my father's people.
Gotcha.
Yeah, so I digress. I'm sorry.
No, that's fine. That's the exact kind of answer I want. So jumping ahead, looking on your website, you have a pretty extensive list of degrees and I guess positions in organizations and such, and fellowships. Can you talk a little bit about your educational journey? And you can start as far back, you know, elementary school, or if you want to start with college, it is your choice.
Yeah, I'll just start with college.
Okay.
I'll go to high school because I went to a very special high school. Jones Commercial High School was a business high school. I think today it would be considered like a magnet school. So they recruited students out of the neighborhood high schools to go to Jones Commercial. And we had to wear hat and gloves, so everyone knew when you were a Jones girl or a Jones guy, because the guys had to wear suits and ties to school every day. Girls had to be in heels, hat and gloves. And it was a business school. So I studied accounting and from there sought to get a degree and become an accountant, and which is why I have a degree in business. And somewhere along that journey, I just discovered my love for art. And this was many years past earning my degree. And so in representing artists, which is where I first began working in the art business and using my marketing and business education to help artists create portfolios and you know, do better in the art business, it evolved. And it evolved from my working with galleries, and this relationship developed because I was seeking, of course, to sell the works of the artists that I represented. Later, I went on to work as assistant curator in some of those galleries and realized that, you know, I was learning a lot through those experiences, what I would do if I had a gallery and what I wouldn't do if I owned my own. So I learned at the expense of others, and realized along the way that I wanted to go back to school and get a formal education in curatorial studies, which is what led me to MICA. And I studied under George Sissel, which was a very privileged opportunity because he's no longer heading the program that I went through.
And this was at MICA?
Yes, the Maryland Institute College of Art. The fellowship came out of my work, and the fellowship is with Michigan State University. They have a wonderful language studies school there. And I've been working in Africa for a number of years, and this fellowship was to learn the Shona language, which is Shoshona. And Shona are the people of Zimbabwe, the indigenous people of Zimbabwe, and Shoshona is the language. And so I went to learn more about the language because I've been working with the Shona sculptors of Zimbabwe for a number of years, and realized that in doing my research and study of the people and the culture, that I really needed to learn more about the language itself. It tells you so much about who people are and their existence. Another motivation for wanting to learn more about the language is because in traveling across the country, and that being in Zimbabwe, realizing the AIDS epidemic was killing a lot of the sculptors who it's a male-dominated profession. And many of the sculptors were dying from AIDS, leaving their wives with no source of income, or either they were picking up their hammer and chisel. The process is done with very rudimentary tools because many live out in the bush and they don't have electricity. So it's still this hammer and chisel process that takes place. And so in wanting to understand more about them and their lives, I decided in order to do that, I had to be able to speak the language. I'd traveled the country with an interpreter who spoke Shoshona well, but had limited capacity in terms of his English.
Oh, wow.
And so I realized the deficit was really mine, right?
Yeah.
Because if I was going to research these women and understand their lives, I needed to be able to communicate with them and understand the nuances of them and the language. So that's what led me to Michigan State. I love Zimbabwe. I love the people there, and it's a beautiful country, and the people are equally as beautiful. I still find the Shona sculpture fascinating, just their belief in why it exists is becoming a lost art, and I think it should garner more attention. Many Europeans have gone to Zimbabwe to study under the master sculptors. And one of the artists that I represent has had the privilege of studying under Nicholas Mukumuranwa, who no longer lives. Scott Johnson is the artist and sculptor that I represent. And he recently had a solo exhibition at the Charles Wright Museum in Detroit, which I had the privilege of curating. So, you know, that's part of my educational background. It all makes sense, you know, when you pull it all together and see what my life's path has been.
Mm-hmm.
But that speaks to my education.
Okay. Well, in your explanation, you kind of hit on another question that I wanted to ask.
Mm-hmm.
Can you talk about your other time in Africa, specifically with the World of, what is it, World of Women of Niger?
Yes.
Well, can you talk about that?
Yeah, I would love to. That was another special project and opportunity for me, which I actually shared with my youngest son, which made it even more amazing.
How old is your son?
At the time, he was 18.
Okay.
So there was a group of us who went over, and this project was actually under Operation Crossroads Africa. And it is the first, or was the first, project in which the group under Operation Crossroads worked with a museum. So the project was with the National Museum of Niger. And we, as a team, went to research and document the utilitarian and ceremonial objects made by women from the 8 nomadic groups. So I have to cheat now, look at my sheet.
That's fine.
Because the groups are the Arab, the Hausa, the Jerma, the Fulani, the Tuareg, the Jurmes, Kumori, and Tubu. And so we lived in the desert. We went on daily excursions that are really hard to describe in terms of the beauty of what we witness. In many cases, it was the hardship and as it relates to the circumstances and the conditions that people lived under. But out of all of that was produced absolutely extraordinary and exceptional items. And I hesitate to call them African art because I really have a problem with that term. Africans are not producing art simply to put things on a shelf so that we can put a label next to it and put lighting on it in our museums and call it art. What they are creating are objects that are used for utilitarian purposes and in ceremony, worship, ritual. And so those were the items that we documented and researched. And those items became part of, or they became the exhibition, The World of Women. And it was really looking at those items and putting them into context and how they use them in their daily lives.
Oh, that sounds like an amazing experience.
Oh, it was absolutely amazing. Part of the experience was that we lived out in the desert for about a week with the Tuaregs in tents and lying on the ground. And one morning I remember being wakened by what I thought was someone holding a flashlight in mm-hmm. my eye, and looked up and it was the moon. I mean, there's no air pollution, right? So the sky is so brilliant and the moon was so bright. It was just incredible. And at the end of our stay, the Tuaregs put on this wonderful ceremony for us. And the men would often come and take my oldest son away because they couldn't understand why this young man was traveling with all these women. Everyone else in the group was a woman. So they gave him his Tuareg name, which is Ahmad, and they told him that he had all these wives waiting for him because he was an American. I said, no, Ahmad is living with his mother, and Ahmad can't have any wives because he doesn't even have a job. So, you know, so all of that to say that that experience was really special, something that I was able to share with my youngest son. He was our technical support person on that project. But I love all of those things that I've, you know, been a part of, and and had an opportunity to experience.
We talked about your educational journey in art, and then we talked about you working in art, but we didn't really talk about how you got into the art world, because on your website it says that you have over 20 years experience as an advisor to private and institutional collectors in the acquisition and sale of fine art. Sorry, are you an art dealer?
I am. I am an art dealer. I began in this business representing artists, kind of toting their wares around and knocking on doors and being the person who gets the yay or nay, you know, the rejection notice or the exception notice on their behalf, and then have to convey that information later. So that's where I began. I began as an artist representative and, again, helping them to develop their portfolios. And as a result of that, you know, you encounter people who are buying their work. And they then became my clients. And so with my business background, I'm always looking for where the voids are. You know, I am in the service industry. I'm either serving my artists or I'm serving the buyers, my clients, and their private collectors or their the institutions. And so in doing the work, I began to realize that my clients on the side of the acquisitions, mm-hmm. that there were other needs that they had. And in recognizing those needs, that became the outgrowth of the advisory and those services that are offered through the gallery.
In that advisory position, do you ever have to travel around the country or even outside of the country?
I do. I've traveled to... What are the travels? The travel is going to, like, I have a contract with a museum, and I'll be going down to make an assessment of artwork that's in their collection that they want to deassess.
Mm-hmm.
I buy at auction for my clients in New York. I consign work for my clients at auctions in New York and other places as well. So again, it's about recognizing client need and then serving them.
Have you ever had to deal with forgeries or stolen art or anything like that? Have you ever experienced that?
I have. And this is why working with other professionals is so important. Forming relationships with appraisers, which have really helped me to develop my, especially the advisory service more greatly and more deeply. And talking to people with different levels of expertise, there's a lot of forgery in the print market because with technology, I mean, people can crank off prints off of a machine that look like they were done by the artist's hands. So where I can't have my feet on the ground and my ear to the ground everywhere, so I call my colleagues and I say, there's something that looks a little suspicious about this, and I need your guidance on it. Can you help me? So, yes, I have encountered it.
With your acquisition and advisory experience, is that what led you to open Gallery Mertisse, looking at those voids and saying, like, hey, you know, I can feel, there is a demand and I can find these products. Why don't I put a gallery together so that people can look at them?
Well, you know, I resisted opening up a gallery for a number of years. I was quite comfortable working out of my home office space and, you know, just doing my thing. And one day, a very dear friend of mine, he's a lawyer by profession, owned a extraordinary and beautiful building on Capitol Hill. And at one point, because of his love of art and because of the void and lack of Black-owned galleries in D.C., he started like selling art in this beautiful building, Italian Renaissance building that's like 11,000 square feet. And I worked as an assistant curator, so that was our first encounter. He had hired a woman to run that space for him. And she and I met while I'm going about, you know, trying to find a place to sell my artist's works. So that he closed his gallery space, but we stayed in touch with each other. He would invite me into his law firm to, you know, show my art to, you know, his law partners and have small receptions. And one day he said, you know, why don't you just launch your gallery? You've been doing this for a number of years. Why don't you launch your gallery? So I talked to my husband, Alex, about it, who has supported my dream for a number of years and helped to make things happen and has helped to shape and to further develop Gallery Matisse to the point where it is now. But it was Larry Harbin who invited me in to launch my gallery, which I did. And I was in his building for 2 years and had decided, and he told me early on that he wanted to soon convert the building to condos. So I knew that my stay there was temporary, but it really helped to raise my public profile and take it to another level. People take you far more seriously when you have a brick and mortar space. And so it just grew from there. And now I'm in Baltimore in a 5,000 square foot building, which serves as gallery / residence. And it has been one of the best decisions my husband and I have ever made in terms of our committing to taking Gallery Matisse to another level. So it's almost like a fairy tale, you know, existence, but it is such hard work, but so rewarding. And the rewards come when, you know, I walk into a museum and see a work that I've sold to them on the wall. Or I go into a client's home and, you know, they talk about the pride that they feel in looking at a painting that reflects who they are, or the beautiful story around buying it, or why it's so significant to them. And then for the artists, just their knowing that I'm working daily to help develop and build their careers, and then the wonderful opportunities that come out of that. So, you know, this is what keeps me humble, and also recognizing that, you know, I feel very privileged to be able to do this because it's, you know, I'm African American, we didn't say that, and it's not a profession that many African Americans exist within. I'm one of very few African American women who own a gallery, contemporary fine art gallery.
Now, is that like up and down the East Coast in the United States? Or
in the United States, I probably know or know of, and there are 10 or less of us in this country that own galleries, mm-hmm. African-American women who own galleries.
And that was important to you?
It's important to me, yes. It absolutely is.
When you first had the idea to open your own gallery, or when you moved to Baltimore, and actually a quick question, when you had your gallery at your friend's space on Capitol Hill down in D.C., were you living in D.C. at the time?
No, I was actually living in Silver Spring, Maryland.
Oh, okay.
So just a stone's throw away.
Gotcha. Yeah. Now, when you were opening Gallery Matisse, or you first had the idea, was being a black woman that owned her own art gallery, was that like another reason for you to open the gallery?
You know, I didn't think of it at the time. I began to understand later the significance and the importance of it. But at the time, what was important to me was to be able to serve the artist at a greater level, to have a presence in D.C.
Mm-hmm.
I, at the time, was one of three gallery owners who was African-American. There were two other gentlemen. Those two galleries, Parrish Gallery, who was one of my mentors, he has since passed away. And then there was Tim of International Visions Gallery, and he's since closed. So I have been told that there are no African-American-owned galleries in D.C. as of today. And there is a huge void that exists with my and their absence.
Now, with that information, have you considered going back to D.C., or are you okay in Baltimore?
I'm really happy in Baltimore. However, void is a word that I often use because I'm always seeking to fill the void. So I am presently looking for opportunities to reintroduce Gallery Mertiz in Washington, D.C., and I've signed on a gentleman, Jarvis Dubois, as an associate of the gallery, and he's helping me. So that, and this just happened in the last 2 weeks, so it is something that I'm seeking to do.
Oh, wow. Well, good luck with that.
Thank you.
Sure. For people who don't know, and when I was talking with other people about interviewing you, especially my sister, you remember my sister Lauren?
Oh, absolutely.
My sister's famous now. she was saying that a lot of the artwork that Gallery Mertiz carries is also bought and displayed on the TV show Empire. How did that come about, and what's it like to see artwork that you have on TV?
It is an absolute thrill. And I am not a television person, okay? Because when you're running a business, who's got time to watch TV?
Mm-hmm.
But when Empire comes on Wednesday evening, folks, we're in front of the screen. Because there is such great pride in seeing the work of the artists that you represent on this television set. That's like, it's an amazing experience. And so when you receive an email from Fox and the art director, first you take a moment, you go, okay, is this another one of those scams where they're trying to get artwork out of your hands? Because that's another, talking about fraud, that's another thing that happens. You're like, you get these crazy emails, we're going to, you know, ship the art to Timbuktu and then we'll send you a check later, that kind of thing. So of course I did my due diligence and investigated it, and the opportunity came because Jamia Richmond Edwards, one of three artists who have their work featured on Fox, on Empire show, Fox discovered us through Jamia. So Jamia was one of the artists that was featured in a Huffington Post article. I'm looking for the name of it. It happened in February 2013, and the article was Black Artists, 30 Contemporary Art Makers Under 40 You Should Know. And she was featured there. And Jamia is a phenomenal woman artist whose work is incredible. And so the art director and the attorney for Fox reached out to us to ask us about using Jamia's imagery on the show, and Mertiz, meeting Mertiz, said, well, if you're looking for artwork, I've got other artists for you to consider. And they were very receptive to that. So they also are using the work of Jeffrey Kent, who's a Baltimore artist, and Arvie Smith, who is a MICA grad but lives in Portland, Oregon now. So we are really pleased to have three of our artists featured on that show. Jamia's work is featured most prominently. She's in Lucius Lyon's living room, that room where the family gathers.
Mm-hmm.
And her piece, Wings Not Meant to Fly, is featured over the fireplace. So it's the image of this beautiful Black woman with this glow, like this gold halo around her. And so we're just, you know, we're thrilled.
You're thrilled.
You know. Oh, gosh. You know, and then to have her work on the set with Kehinde Wiley and all of the other, like, famous African-American artists is just amazing.
That's great. We talked about your gallery, and we've also talked about where some of the artwork goes. But we didn't really talk about who the artists that you show or represent. So who do you carry in Gallery Mertiz?
Yeah, well, we represent 13 artists. We specialize in the work of African-American artists, but we don't solely represent African-American artists. One of the things I learned early on in my art experience in dealing with other galleries is that I did not want to run a segregated art gallery, that I was going to represent in my gallery the artists whose works I loved, that I could stand behind and help promote. So we have the work of contemporary artists and who are national, regional, and international, and known throughout those regions. And also, because of my advisory service, I also sell the work from private estates. private collection, but I provide collection management services. So mm-hmm. sometimes there are individuals or institutions that want to deassess work from their collections, and that work is also featured in the gallery at times.
How has art impacted your life?
Wow, it has enriched my life in ways that I could have never imagined. As a result of it, I got Alex, my husband. We met at an exhibition that I curated. I just returned from a fellowship in South Africa where I studied the work of the black South African artists, work that was created during the apartheid era, and also work that was created by the Afrikaners. So culmination of that became an exhibition that I curated in Washington, D.C., At that point, it was the gallery that I was curating for, which later became the space where Gallery Matisse was launched. So Alex was there, and I'm walking around doing a curatorial talk, and I kept seeing him out of the periphery of my eye, and we later talked, and the rest is history. So that's how that came about.
Does he work in the art world as well?
He does not. Well, he does by way of our owning the gallery. If you look at our website and you're impressed with it, that's Alex's hands at work. But he's an IT professional.
Oh, okay.
And he works for the Association of School Psychologists.
Oh, wow. That's.
He's a director there.
Oh, wow. That sounds great. Is Gallery Matisse open to the public?
It is. It is. Normal business hours are Thursday through Saturday from 2 until 6, Tuesday and Wednesday by appointment. And of course, as you know, we have special events on Sundays at times.
Sure. Do you have any of those special events coming up?
I do. I believe it's May 22nd, but check out our site. We will be having a Tea with Matisse. It's a series of art salons that I host at the gallery, in which we ask professionals from different areas of the arts to come in and talk. And our next exhibition is Art of the Collectors. It'll be our fifth iteration of that. And we will have the curator from the Reginald Lewis Museum, Charles Bethea, Larry Frazier, who's an attorney.
Is he an art collector?
Larry is one of the major art collectors in the area in Washington, D.C. He's a D.C. attorney.
Mm-hmm.
I will also have on the panel Julie Menicelli from the Walters. And there is one other panelist that's escaping me at the moment. But we will all be talking about the transference of an art collection to family members, and also the process of donating to museums.
Interesting.
Oh, I'm sorry. Janice Lee. An appraiser, and she will also be on the panel.
Okay. Now I have a question for you. This is a little related. Do you watch documentaries often? I know that you have
yes.
a business.
Yes.
Have you ever heard of the documentary The Art of the Steal about the Barnes Foundation?
Absolutely, I have.
Oh, what'd you think of it?
Oh, I thought it was wonderful, telling. I've been to the Barnes in its original building, mm-hmm. which was Dr. Barnes' home, and now at the new place. It was really interesting that, you know, his commitment to Lincoln University, where the collection was donated, and then ultimately and sadly the fact that the university gave up the collection, and then now what's become of it. So this is one of the reasons why it's important to know the value of art, the importance of it, and sadly for me, you know, the university no longer has ownership over it, and that it was moved, and so it's really amazing, and this is a telling about the powers that be and what money can do, because Dr. Barnes really wanted that collection to remain in his home, and that it be accessible primarily to the African-American community,
mm-hmm.
so it was great loss. It's still available to the public, and I think that that's really wonderful, but mm-hmm. unless you read the book, you really don't have a grasp
get the
and
full
understanding
story.
Of the full story. Yes.
Gotcha. Now, one last question. I feel like a lot of people who are not in the art world, or I guess casual admirers or fans of art, they like to go to museums, of course, because it's culturally enriching and entertaining. But as a dealer, as an advisor, as someone who's worked in the art industry for so long and has such prestige in that world, how can an average museum goer enjoy going to the museum? Because I feel like when you go, you have to look at the art and be very critical and think like, oh, well, how does this make me feel? So from someone who's been in the game for so long, how do you look at art?
I think I look at it probably a little bit different than most people, but perhaps not. What I look for in the art is a reflection of me. I'm looking to relate to it based on my aesthetic preferences and also my experiences in life. And I think if people go into a museum setting or a gallery setting and they look at the art and look to find within the work that's being displayed something that resonates with them, work that speaks to them and who they are, I think they'll find it a far more enjoyable experience.
All right. Is there anything you want to talk about that we haven't already gone over?
I just want to thank you for the opportunity to be here and express to you how much I appreciate it.
Oh, absolutely. I thank you for accepting my invitation. When Lauren told me who you were and what you did, I was just like, yeah, there's no way. She's like, why would she even respond to me? But
oh, come on, man. I said humble, remember? I'm humble.
Well, Mertice, I want to thank you. Oh, I'm sorry. Really quick, how can people find Gallery Mertice online?
Yes, I would love for you all to visit the gallery online and certainly come and visit us in person. But for the moment, you may find us at gallerymertice.com. And all right, here's the tricky part. Gallery is spelled the French way, which is G-A-L-E-R-I-E. And my first name is Mertice. It's M as in Mary, Y-R-T-I-S.com. So come out and see us. We'd love to have you.
Gotcha. Have you retained any of your, was it Shona? Shauna? Mm-hmm. Could you just say goodbye?
In Shona? Oh my God, I can't believe, I will say Kwete, because that means no. And I will say, I will reach you in the morning greeting that I remember.
Okay.
Which is Magunani.
Magunani.
Yes.
Wow, fantastic. Well, Mertice, thanks for your time. Thanks for sitting down with me.
You're welcome. Thank you.
Local Color is written, produced, directed, edited, and engineered by me, Jason V. Local Color's theme music was composed and provided with permission by MobyGratis.com. Find Local Color online at localcolorpod.tk, where you can also follow Local Color on Twitter and Instagram, and like on Facebook. Web hosting for Local Color is provided by Skylar Newman, with media hosting provided by Blueberry Podcasting Services. I'm Jason V, and I'll be back with more Local Color.